Ed, can you actually do our intro for us?
Go on.
So we go back, you go,
What's
what's left?
left?
Back
Back
again
again.
in the stew.
Yeah.
And you can say with Freddie and Javan. Right, ready? You got this.
Yeah.
Is that you don't
Yeah,
need it and
yeah,
then.
yeah.
You are one line in it. You're magic
Yeah.
like that. Go on.
What's left? Back in the stew with Freddie and Javan.
How the fuck have we done this then? Sorry. Oh, Ed, am I allowed to swear in front of
We
you?
are
To swear.
definitely, yeah.
Okay, perfect. We do swear a little bit on the podcast. You are the first cabinet
First.
minister on What's Left.
Yeah,
I feel
big
honored.
ups. I
Well,
feel honored.
we feel honored. I mean, ex-Labour leader,
Yeah.
current
Ex
secretary.
lots of things, actually. Ex
Go on.
podcaster.
Ex, yeah. Oh, of course. You're one of the
Ex
OGs. We've got your water here.
Rubik's
Johnsy,
Cube.
coming in. It's fine. We're that chill as a podcast. You could just step
You
in.
can
Just
just, yeah.
walk in and leave with water.
Ex Rubik's Cube
Holder.
doer.
Holder. You could do Rubik's Cube.
I could do a Rubik's Cube in
How quickly?
like a minute and a half,
Oh,
actually.
that's pretty
Really? Yeah,
impressive.
but not anymore.
Do you like lead with that when people say like fun facts about me? What's your kind of like go-to thing now? Cold
I'm
water
pretty cool.
swimmer.
Yeah, it's like pretty boring, isn't it? You kind of
You what?
know.
You were one of the
Yeah.
progenitors of the cold water swim, weren't you? You and Alistair.
I know, but people just, I find it, you know, this guy said once, nobody who's ever been cold water swimming hasn't boasted about it. And it is
So
sort of
that
that
is
kind
that's a
of,
fact.
we're
Yeah,
just
definitely. And
like,
they're all the same
it's like
middle-class
the vegans,
people.
it's the
It,
vegans and the
yeah,
cold water swim at them.
yeah.
No offense to the vegans, but they also tell you they're
They're
vegan
vegans.
and
Yeah,
cold water.
yeah.
So
I need
it's
to.
kind of like, you have to, I think
Cold
maybe.
water swim is the male vegan, isn't it? It's the I'm trying to. What I'm trying to say here is that obviously I'm so tortured as a bloke that the only thing that can make me feel real again is to have all my digits feel like they're about to fall off my body.
Yeah, that is true.
That's
Pretty awful.
and obviously.
Particularly certain digits feel as they're going to fall off your body.
What is the fun in it? I don't see any appealing notion of.
It's so, well, look, what's, I was in at 14 yesterday, 14 degrees, and it was, I was thinking, well, it was starting to cool down. It is quite invigorating. And actually then in the summer when you go in, it's like fantastic when it's 17 or 18 or 19.
Yeah. But they say it releases was like 2.5 times your dopamine levels.
My big claim to fame is that there was, I was talking about this on a interview a few years ago, and then there was a paparazzi in the bushes, right, trying to take a photo of me in my
And your
speedo,
budgie smugglers.
and Benedict Cumberbatch was swimming, and he said, "I think there's a paparazzi that might be looking for me." Found the paparazzi
I'd
looking
Ed.
for me, so that is a big
Did
claim to
you
fame.
correct him?
No, I didn't.
I love it. I think it is actually really good for you. Like for me, when I had a bit of a wobble with my mental health a few years ago, I had an older friend, a colleague, who was a bit like a work dad, and he was like, "You need to come with me to come and do this because this is going to help you get out of this like mental cycle that you're in." And it worked.
I do feel better. Honestly, yesterday I was like neurosing about something, which is my tendency. And I was like, okay, I know I've got all this to do, conference, da, da, da. I've got to go and just, and I didn't do very long. I did like 15 minutes, but I felt a lot better.
Yeah. But do you think that that's a thing about how in modern society, in the jobs that we do,
Yeah.
we spend so long behind a desk that the moment we get to go out there and just do something physical,
Got
new
the
and
duck.
engages
I mean,
our
Alistair
doing?
and I have this disagreement because I like the pond because it's like got the ducks and the birds and all of that. He's like a Lido person. I mean, I'm not against Lido people, just so you know. I actually, li I've got a confession though, which is I listen to podcasts while swimming.
Yes, yeah. I remember finding that out about you last year.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Chapel Roan. You're a big Chapel
Chapel
Roan.
Row.
Oh,
Chapel
yeah.
Row, yeah. Pink Pony Club, yeah.
Who have you discovered this year? I mean, we're meant to talk about conference or something, but you
Yeah.
know, who have you discovered? Who's your artist of this year?
Chapel Roan,
Still
definitely.
Chapel
I
Roan.
feel really sad because I nearly went, this is like not a claim to fame, I nearly went to the Leeds Festival. But
Right.
basically, the Leeds Festival is for people who've done their GCSEs.
A bit nonsense.
Ed, you can't be seen there, my brother. You
You
can't be
can't
seen
be
there, my
seen
brother. Well, I
there.
know, but a friend of mine,
Reading is worse, but definitely not
Katie
Leeds.
White, who's now a minister in my department, she was going with her kids, and I nearly, was like, I nearly went with her, but it just seemed, she's, Chapel Run is just
She's
amazing.
a force of nature.
She's a complete
Yeah,
force of nature.
she's captured the zeitgeist in an incredible way. Can I put you onto a UK-based artist who's
Go on.
coming up?
Yeah.
Tracy.
Tracy.
Tracy, yeah. So Tracy are like this eclectic hyper pop duo. They're kind of faceless.
With an E or without an E?
Tracey, but it's two people. We don't know their identity, but they're like the up and coming thing right now.
And what do you think is the What's the secret of Chapel Row? Why has Chapel Row been so successful?
God, that's a good question. I think there was a sense that pop music was waiting for someone new with a different aesthetic, still raw, incredible voice. And she's just incredibly personable, right? She captures that generation's attitude.
But also, I think there is something quite odd. I mean, look, Pink Pony Club is like a great tune, as they say. as they don't say. But there's also something very moving about it, actually.
Yeah. It's real music.
Well, there's something very moving about the lyrics,
yeah.
Don't you think?
It's about being accepted, right?
Being accepted, yeah. You know, where she could be who she was.
Not apologising for yourself.
Yeah, exactly, all of that.
Yeah, and that's your politics, isn't it?
Well, aspiring. It's all,
you're still apologising.
Always a work in progress. always a work in progress. Humility is important, always a work in progress.
So, Ed, look, we're at conference, yeah. We're joking and having a laugh, but how are you reading the vibe out there?
The vibe is anxious, obviously. You know, the vibe was great celebration last July. People delighted we're in government after 14 years, and it's important not to lose sight of that. But people are anxious about reform and the threat of reform. I think people are anxious about the mood of the country. I'm anxious about the mood of the country. Yeah. You know, when you see the Tommy Robinson rally,
of course, yeah.
You know, someone said to me, I was just doing an event earlier and someone was asking me about that. And, you know, it's important to sort of say, well, what Clive Lewis, I think, was doing some good tweeting about this, you know, the MP.
Yeah.
Why, you know, why were people on that march? Why were people at that rally? What is the anger that people have? Some people, no doubt, on that were racist, but I think it goes a lot deeper than that. You know, it goes a lot deeper than that. And it's like really important to understand that, I think.
Firstly, do you think the government understands the kind of nuances of all of this? Because I feel like when I see what's going on, there's such haste, a bit like what Clive Lewis was trying to dissipate, I guess, like the haste around labelling people as racist or as bigots or anything else. Do you think the government has a command as to actually what that anxiety looks like and why it's manifesting in the way it is? Because 14 years of the Tories is such an easy thing to say.
Look, I don't know. Let me say on behalf of like myself, which is the best I can speak about, why I think people are angry. I think people are angry, and I think it's really important that we spell this out because of two dominant Tory ideas that have dominated the last 30 of the last 40 years in Britain. One was what they call trickle-down economics. So if you cut taxes for the richest, get rid of the welfare state, attack the unions.
It didn't trickle down, bro.
It didn't trickle down. And then New Labour came in and did some good things, but then the sucker punch was austerity. You know, cut and cut again, and people then, the local services people rely on disappear. And it was terrible for growth and living standards and since the financial crisis, all of that. And so that's why people are angry. And they're not wrong to be angry.
No, it's entirely justified to be fuming about that. It's entirely justified. And this is the problem, isn't it, to a certain extent, though, is that there's legitimate grievances and then there's grievances that are being exploited.
Here's the thing I think, which is we've got to do a better job, we the government, we the Labour Party, of calling out reform's explanation for the problems of the country. They say it's migration, diversity, net zero. That is just nonsense. That is not why the health service is in a mess. Right? We're putting it right, but that's not why we inherited such a mess in the health service. That's not why people's living standards were on the floor. And you've got to, that battle needs to be joined. The analysis about what's gone wrong needs to be joined in order to win the argument about what to put right.
And in all of that, though, the government doesn't seem to have a grip on, like, the comms, the most effective way of communicating that, because it is just a bit more of a sophisticated and kind of complex message to put out to people. Reform are just saying these things, xenophobic, racist, nationalist stuff. Why can't we, as left, as progressive-minded people who have all of the aspirations for a better society, why can't we just say it as clearly as
and
what
why
Reform
do you,
are saying?
Why do you think it is that we're not doing that? What's your, as you know, in a way, I'm in the government, you've got probably a better perspective, better judgment on this.
Well, I mean, I always say, and I think this is kind of true, the Labour Party is... It's a 20th century party led by 20th century men. I still think we haven't really brought ourselves into the 21st century. Reform are using all of the techniques of a modern age.
Interesting.
Trump's doing all of the same things as well. And I just think the Labour Party need to kind of build a kind of ideological, political, social, cultural program that meets where people are today. And until Labour actually understand that and they can communicate that in maybe more simple terms, then we can kind of start to attack some of the beast. But I think we haven't even got to the, like, the basic essence as to what does a 21st century progressive project look like.
Can I build on that? I think we want to be the guardians of complexity, because we know the world is complex, right? It's not simple. And so when you see a populist put out, you know, a 3-second soundbite, our natural inclination is to say, it's much more complicated than that. But when people see the world changing negatively around them, what they want is someone to articulate their anger and their upset.
Here's what I would say is the problem about Britain is that for too long it's been run for the rich and powerful. It needs to be run for ordinary working people.
For the many, not for the few.
That, exactly. That is my, originally Tony Blair's slogan. That is, it says on our party card, right? Yeah. Power, wealth and opportunity in the hands of the many, not the few.
Exactly. But this is the thing, is that post-Corbyn, I think people were like, well, we can't have that as our slogan. We can't have that be part of our mission. We want to be, I don't know, we want to be pragmatic. You know, we just want to do stuff.
Ultra-pragmatic, but, it seems to me.
But that is common. It's,
we need a bit of heart. And Javan, to be fair to him, has brought me more onto that mission, because I was probably more of a rudderless pragmatist, you know, this kind of thing of like, You've just got to do stuff. But there's a sense that people are not coming along with us on this journey because they don't see and feel what it is we're trying to do.
I don't think it's non-pragmatic. I don't see this as non-pragmatic somehow. You know, I mean, it's obviously it's got ideology and ideas at the root of it. You see, I think that ideas are the most underestimated commodity of British politics. Mm-hmm. And I think ideas really matter. Thinking, you know, what we've tried to do in my agenda is think, well, you know, why were we in a mess on energy as a country? Our reliance on fossil fuels, not just because of climate. That's why bills shot up, you know, after Russia invaded Ukraine. This is the biggest source of good jobs in the future. And if you go to how do you create that, how do you really create an economy with power, wealth and opportunity for the many, not the few? This is a crucial part of it. What some people call the Green New Deal. So, but look, you know, government's hard, but I think you know, some of your critique is fair enough. But
Luke Trill said it to us, the CEO of More in Common. Is he executive director of More in Common?
I listened to that episode.
Yeah. You're a listener.
I did. I was on my bicycle listening to that. My advisor out of shot said that we should. He sent it around and said, everybody must listen to this.
These guys are fucking shit.
Followed and subscribed.
No, I don't know anything about that stuff. I've not been on social media. I mean, look, I'm lucky enough to have people who do this stuff for me, but I've not been on social media for years, and my mental health, going back to cold water swimming, is miles
way, way better. Yeah. No, yeah, reasonable. I mean, what Luke was saying, though, was that, you know, you go down quite well, actually, in terms of communications with voters, because they feel a sense of, you know, what the mission is with you. They have an understanding about what you're trying to achieve and what the means are of getting there. I guess what's really interesting, of course, is that Reform have chosen, you know, you're doing as a wedge issue, as a way to, this is a place to fight on, this is territory to fight you on.
Great, bring it on, I say.
You ready to scrap?
Yeah, ready to scrap. 100%.
How many do you think you, Richard Tyson, should do a boxing match for Net Zero?
The boxing match, I'm not so sure. I don't know about his boxing skill. I'm not in favour of violence. I'm not in favour of violence. A sort of, verbal boxing match.
You know the YouTube boxing thing?
I don't.
So this is how, like, all YouTubers now settle their beef, is that they must do a boxing match.
Well, it's good to
Mark
be
Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk have a...
MMA.
Yeah, something.
I think that's a bit pathetic.
I'm not challenging Richard Tice to an MMA or whatever that is.
Okay, well, we've got the exclusive on that one, guys.
But
you are ready to have a verbal spar. You're ready to verbally
Clearly, he said he wanted to wage war on clean energy investment. That is waging war on 400,000 workers in clean energy at the moment and 400,000 more jobs that we can have by 2030, right? Let's have the argument.
Yeah.
And by the way, he also apparently drives an EV. His company benefits from, we've got some company that does solar panels.
He invested in solar energy.
Yeah,
years
I mean,
years
like,
ago,
for
right?
goodness sake, I mean, come off it.
On the jobs thing, though, I'm genuinely quite interested, because there's all this talk about AI taking jobs and like we're entering this new age about how we interact with like the workforce and everything. But your department still needs like actual people to go and do stuff. Like 100%. It's a green industrial revolution, 100%. Would you call it?
Tens of thousands of engineers, tens of thousands of, you know, fitters and welders and, you know, construction workers. Honestly, like, we're going to publish this plan in like 2 or 3 weeks' time. And it's all about, you know, these are the jobs of the 10 industrial sectors that the government identified. This is the fastest growth. The net zero economy grew 3 times faster than the economy as a whole. Last year. But behind every statistic is like a person.
Exactly.
You know, and what it means for people. And by the way, the Chinese get this.
Yeah.
Right?
No.
But they're like cruising ahead with all this.
Mm. Yeah. They really get it. I mean, on the jobs front in particular, one of our concerns, of course, is that deindustrialization has been the kind of fuel behind the populist movement, right? These communities that were have been left behind. We've had miners who are the aristocracy of the working class left behind.
It's the mainstay of kind of the body politic now. I grew up in a deindustrialized area.
Where
actually, West Brom. I actually joined the Labour Party because of you. I joined in 2014. But like, I could see what you were trying to do. And this seems to be the kind of underbelly of kind of British society now. Deindustrialized communities. People growing up my age who still feel as though something is just not working. And then you marry that up with the AI stuff. And then you're telling a load of people that their jobs aren't going to exist. And then on the one hand, you're saying that we need welders. Who do we believe? Who are we to turn to as like a whole generation where we need the jobs, we need the work, we need stability, but it's kind of supposedly coming on one hand and then it's supposedly coming in the other? What do you say?
Well, it's a really good and interesting question. I think in the world we're in, we, you know, creating good, well-paying jobs is absolutely crucial, whatever AI means. And, you know, I don't know where AI is going to take us, but obviously we've got to manage that technological change. But what I know from my own area is there are all these jobs available. Now, by the way, one of the things I'm going to be saying this in my conference speech on Wednesday is these have to be jobs with strong trade unions. Because part of what's happened over the last 30 or 40 years, the trade unions have been hollowed out.
Gutted.
And people are incredibly, you know, it's incredibly precarious for people. You know, I saw that in the 2000s in my own constituency. This conversation I used to have with Gordon Brown when he was Chancellor and then Prime Minister is that when I was kind of growing up politically in the 80s and 90s, it was like, can we achieve full employment, right? Well, we have got high levels of employment. So why are people unhappy? Because these jobs are so precarious, you know, 0 hours, power imbalances at work, all of those things have got to be part of the conversation. And by the way, my quite tough message to the renewable sector is don't think with us you can get away with being like a unions free zone, you know, because trade unions are really, really important in this. So look, I don't, as I say, we've got to manage the technological change of AI. We've also got to take the opportunities that exist. And, you know, the other thing about clean energy is just talking to, like, I'm just talking to an apprentice at Sizewell recently, which is with the new nuclear, you know, just he was so proud of what he was doing, partly because it was a good job and he didn't have to leave his hometown and all that. He's from Ipswich. But also because he knew he was contributing the right thing to the future of the planet.
Yeah.
What's not to like?
Well, that's we're at our best when we're thinking about a great future. We're thinking about a future that we can achieve and we can fashion. I guess the challenge is that, especially with net zero, there are some complications on that journey. It's not a one and singular track and direction of travel. And so there's a few things I want to put to you on that front, right? Number one, we've got some of the highest unit energy costs for industry in Europe, right? That's a problem.
You know, can I tell you why that is?
Please.
So Russia invaded Ukraine. Gas prices shot up. Businesses and families paid the price. Gas prices, wholesale gas prices, still 75% higher than they were before Russia invaded Ukraine. Nearly double what they were. That's why bills are so high. And that's the fossil fuel penalty people are paying. And unless we get to clean power, unless we change that, we're all of these dictators and petrostates have got their boot on our throat. You know, some country does something, there's problems in the Middle East, prices go through the roof, we pay more. And fracking and all that nonsense is never going to solve that, because all of this is sold on the world market, basically.
You're an ambitious guy.
Yeah.
And these are long-term kind of trends that the country's been moving in. Do you think you can solve it in 3.5 years' time? Because that's the time between now and the next election.
I think we can show progress. I think we can show progress. And I think we can have people say, well, my local school, there'll be 200
schools and 200 hospitals have got GB Energy solar panels. My local school's got solar panels, cut the energy bills, put money into frontline services. Do we really want to roll all that back? Well, there are these jobs that people are doing. Do we really want to roll all that back? I mean, it's all very simplistic to say, oh, we just don't want all of this and so on. But also, imagine the cost of building lots of new gas plants. Yeah.
But it's not guaranteed, though. I mean, if we look to the States, for instance, as a guide on this, right? Yeah. Biden,
so well there, yeah.
Yeah, Biden invested in all these red states, yeah. Jobs of the future, very similar plans, Securenomics, it's all kind of the same school of thought. And obviously, they haven't fully rowed back on those commitments because people are in employment there. But it didn't stop them from bringing about a new government. And on the other hand, I would also add, whilst China have made huge inroads about developing this technology, and Xi Jinping came out the other day to say that there's commitments around carbon, right? I mean, this is a new world we're living in. China are making commitments. They've reached peak carbon in their view, right? Which is a big deal because they were the biggest emitter. But also, they own all this tech, so how do we stop ourselves from transferring from being under the boot of Putin, etc., to being dependent on China?
Invest in our own. Look, we've got the thing I say to my department all the way along is we are not just an energy policy department, we're an industrial policy department. Industrial policy became a dirty word, right? A dirty phrase. And we've got to invest in our own supply chains. It's hard, this, by the way, because there's a whole, sorry to use the sort of jargon, but neoliberalism about the way the system works. GB Energy is like the first publicly owned energy company in 70 years.
Yeah.
And I was talking to the head of GB Energy yesterday, and it's just all, he's saying, he came from the renewable sector, how do we build the supply chains here? I actually think, though, it's interesting about net zero, people are more on our side than Westminster thinks. Westminster is overestimating the backlash. People still support net zero by 3-1.
Do you blame the lobby for that? For the journalists?
I don't know whether I blame them, but it's just, I think they're wrong. And now Luke Trill is really good on this, actually. Luke is the corrective, saying, hang on, you're saying all this, but it's not right. There isn't this revolt. By the way, the other thing I learned, I've been at this a long time, is the only point in being in politics is not to slice and dice, but to say what you think. You've got to say what you think. I mean, I think focus groups are useful, but in the end, I think actually politics has changed a lot since the 90s. If you think about the success of Johnson, for example, if you think about the success of Trump, it's because, I I'm not supporters. I'm not a supporter of Johnson, and I'm diplomatic about Trump. But there's this thing about we've got to say what we think, and then let the chips fall where they may.
On that though,
I didn't do that, by the way, when I was Labour leader.
What did you make of Trump's comment to Erdogan the other day?
Rigged election. He knows about rigged elections better than anybody. When I was in exile, we were still friends. That's always a good way to find out, test of friendship. But
the thing I would say is, I want to praise Keir here because, America is not just our closest ally, it's a power in the world. I think the way he has handled Trump, I know it hasn't satisfied everybody because the easier thing to do would be to respond tweet by tweet. But what he's had in mind is, how do I protect our national interest? Mm. And I do think this is something interesting about, important about politics. I know that he's had the JLR workers in his mind, what would tariffs do to them? And he could have got lots of likes for a sort of, he said tweet war, but he decided not to do that because he thought the responsible thing to do. So, just sort of saying that.
Lowest tariffs in the world, right? At the end of the day, he's got, his job is to protect British interests and he's got a good deal for this country. And I think even us who are highly critical of MAGA and Trump and the populists understand ultimately that country before party means doing stuff like that. Izzy Miyake. Whose bit do you like more? Do you like Javan's more or do you like mine?
Why is this a difficult...
Well, Javan, I knew from the get-go, from pre... It was going to be incredibly smart and trendy. But Hideo Miyake.
Look at that. Look at the leg of that. It's unbelievable.
I know. You can't really
pick. I think you could pull off a full pleat 100%.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Hideo Miyake coming soon to a to a parliamentary moment for you.
Now that would do a stir in both.
What's the origins of the Izzy Miyake?
Izzy Miyake is actually an engineer, so he's actually quite up your street, but he's also a fashion designer. He sadly no longer with us.
I'm sorry.
But his designs, this pleat, these are, you don't really need to like not do anything for these. They just hang like this.
Comfy?
So comfy. And in fact, they do go down well with the ladies as well.
Which is an important thing just to bear in mind sometimes if you play true life with clients.
Okay. That's useless. No, I'm gonna stop. I'm not gonna assume that. I'm not gonna
assume that. Well, Ed, look, you've been the first ever cabinet minister, ex-Labour leader on What's Left. We are so, so grateful to have you.
And
on.
Honestly, it's and like important what you're doing because like we've got to be in all of these spaces.
You've got to be in the conversation.
You've got to be in the conversation and, you know, wrestling with the difficulties. I think one of the things, you know, because I came of age under New Labour, and New Labour was all about message discipline. You know, that was the whole thing. You can't say a word out of place. And that's sort of the way I tried to operate as Labour leader. I had a number of words out of place, a sandwich out of place, a stone out of place. But I think that's not what people want anymore, actually. I think what people want is, and I don't, authenticity is a sort of overused cliche, but I think what people want is, you know, just
real.
Well, as real as it can be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just sincerity. I'm not going to lie. I think people look at politicians and they're like, I'm done with these people. Yeah. I'm so done.
We can see through the lies. You can't look, you have the privilege of being yourself. Don't try and be anyone else. You know.
And I think we're just trying to do that.
Also, well, it's slightly like a what's the, you know, I slightly feel like what's the point? You know, do we face a fight on net zero? Of course we do. But is it the right thing to do? Do I passionately believe that we will be, you know, I've got kids who are 16 and 14 and, you know, there's sacrifices in politics, but I still think to myself, well, actually, I'm fighting for your future and it's worth it for that. And otherwise, it's like, you know, it's just otherwise, I kind of slightly feel what's the point? I can, you know, go off and, you know, tend to my garden and, you know, I'm not a very good gardener, but, you know, yes. go do more, you know, more time with my cold water swimming, you know.
Edmund, man, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for the trousers.
Cheers. There you go.
I was really popular on Vine and then they abolished it. Maybe I need to get on TikTok.
Okay, that was mental. Are you gassed?
I mean, I literally joined the Labour Party because of this guy. And we sat here chatting to him, so yeah, I can't lie. I'm pretty happy.
Full circle moment. Yeah. I mean, I think what's mad is that Ed even listens to our podcast.
Yeah, he's listening to What's Left.
What's the hell? Your favourite politician listens to What's Left. Did you know that? Like, that's crazy. But do you know what it is about him as well? There's not that many people who can do that. Just sit in that seat
and just vibe out. Yeah.
Pretty authentically, you know, uninhibited. And the thing about Ed is he actually, like, when he gets a hard question, it activates him. It pushes him on.
He's an ideas guy. And that's one thing that I think most people can get a sense of him about is, like, he's a guy who seriously thinks about ideas and really tries to kind of rally a crowd around something he sees merit in. And that just comes across so honestly, so sincerely, so authentically. And also with, like, loads of fun, passion, and genuine curiosity. And I think, I don't know, that kind of came across today, right?
He's not afraid to laugh at himself. I think we didn't have enough time to really get into some of the, like, the policy about some of the stuff that net zero is. I'm like, one of the things I wanted to ask him, which we didn't get time for, was this idea that if we don't lower bills in the course of this parliament and reach some significant milestones, public consent for net zero will drop. Mm-hmm. And whilst it still is popular, and that is an important caveat, reforms bet is that's what's going to happen. And I feel like there needs to be some level of urgency there that might require us to look outside the net zero bubble.
Yeah.
You know, maybe a bit to oil and gas, sorry guys, just for a bit, just so we can lower those bills because people are really struggling right now.
And I think there's that, but the other thing that I wanted to, it's not really even grill him on, but kind of get an answer about is he's doing all of this brilliant stuff around net zero and really kind of trying to change the tune around what a modern environmental strategy looks like. But at the same time, the government is expanding Heathrow and it's committed to building an extra runway at Gatwick. And there's a load of, it seems, kind of incoherences around some of the policy agenda. So Ed's trying to do kind of really radical and exciting things that's infusing like a whole generation of people who care about the environment and showing that it can really kind of transform people's lives and people's communities. And at the same time, another wing of the government is kind of doing something different in the name of kind of growth. And I just wanted to, well, next time we'll be able to pick it up, but what does a kind of environmental growth strategy look like where Ed can really kind of immerse himself and it kind of form a program for government?
It's like the America stuff though, isn't it? It's like on the one hand, do you have an ideological, you know, place where you want to go and where your heart and values are? And on the other hand, you have you have to steer the ship practically for the rocks ahead. And I guess expanding Heathrow on the one hand is part of this bid to get growth in our economy. But of course, it's going to run up against these environmental concerns. And what strikes me about Ed is that ultimately he's got to argue one specific part of that argument, and that's just his focus. And that's politics, right? Like ultimately, some people are going to have that battle of ideas, and some compromise is going to have to be found in the middle. He is right to say that people are feeling anxious right now at this conference. This is a different vibe to what it was last year. And even last year wasn't exactly jubilant. But there is a sense right now that this government needs to turn things around quickly because Reform are ahead in the polls. They are planning some really scary, you know, policy ideas. And unless we figure out a project to rival that and figure out what's left, they could be the people who are next in charge of this government. Anything else you want to add, my good man?
He's an ideas guy, and I just value and appreciate that we've got someone at the top of government, the top of the Labour Party, who kind of really seriously thinks about things, and that needs to be championed and celebrated so much more. The kind of intellectual vibrancy that I think he brings is so refreshing and so needed. And so, I don't know, I just wish him well in all of the stuff that he's kind of doing in his department. But hopefully we'll get to kind of grill him on some of the kind of more challenging aspects and he can bring all of that kind of stuff together.
Yeah. And it's unions, it's industry, it's jobs. You know, if we can actually deliver, if we deliver that, that's labor. That is what labor is. So fingers crossed, Ed, thank you so much for coming on. Big ups, Ed's special advisor who listens to the podcast as well. It wouldn't have been possible without you. This is our life now. This is what the fuck is left. This is what the fuck is left. Thank you for listening. Yo, pause. What? We've got a whole nother episode for you built in this episode with Ed. What are you talking about? We were at back-to-back conferences, guys. Before Labour Conference, it was the Global Progress Action Summit where we were talking and reflecting on how to beat the populist right. So stay tuned now for a chat about digital ID, immigration, what the left can learn from the populist right, and an interview with the Biden-Harris border czar. It's proper serious stuff. Grab yourself a tea, hit interval, pause, and let's go again.
What's left? Back again.
Booyakasha!
We're at the Global Progress Action Summit here in central London, which seems to be demonstrating a bit of a reorganisation for the Global Centre-Left project, trying to bring together leaders from all around the world to truly find out what's left for you, me, and society as we understand it today.
Yeah, it's a pretty mad place to be. I mean, I can't believe they've invited us, of all people, to be discussing the future of the left. A fledgling podcast. You know that the left's in trouble when we're out here with Westminster Abbey in the background at Central Methodist Hall, right? This place was, I believe, the home of the first convention of the UN. And today...
Big ups Labour.
Big ups Labour. And today it's the home of the modern left, of the leaders of the world, trying to figure out what the hell we're meant to do in the face of the rising populist right. Now, I think it's good that this is happening. Like, obviously, I'm delighted that we're here. But, you know, the right have been way more organized than the left when it's come to matters of global coordination. And you can see that in the way that Hungary and the plans that Viktor Orban executed there were then copied essentially as a playbook now in the US. There is a sense that information is being shared and it's being worked together by people on the right who want to foment a new type of politics.
From AI, the information wars, digital technology, the right has been setting the tone and the left has been on the back foot. We've been in government now for almost 18 months and it still seems hard to get any cut through, both here in the UK and across the world. From borders, national security, digital ID, it seems only now that the left is starting to have a bit of a response as to how to address some of these challenges for today.
It's not to say that the left aren't trying. It's not to say that the people in charge aren't cut out for the job. It's that we're living in really, really crazy times, right? The kind of political consensus that upheld what we understood to be the principles of governance have changed. They fundamentally shifted. And we've seen that with problems like migration, for instance, be so divisive politically for our coalition of voters, but also for a wider part of the population who think that they now need to turn to far-right populist solutions.
And this morning, the Prime Minister launched his most scathing attack on reform and their policy to scrap indefinite leave to remain.
I do think that is a racist policy. I do think it's immoral and needs to be called out for what it is.
And do you think
the truth is people don't feel like politicians listen to them, politicians hear them, because they're not seeing anything happen in government that actually materially transforms their life, right? People have not had a pay rise for 40 years. And now we're in a position where people are looking at quite radical solutions to problems that they think that will never be fixed because they can't trust politicians.
I guess one of the fundamental questions I ask myself is, have we been too wedded to 20th century notions of how to solve society? And today it seems as though the left is finally just breaking through into the 21st century. But how effective are those solutions going to be? And this is what we're here to find out.
And I get why the left has often, you know, gone back to like the ideas of like Blair and Brown and like the New Labour years to create a project that can work. They want to rehash what worked of that era. But I do think that there's something in this shifting sands, you know, of politics right now. There's something different. Politics feels meaner. It feels more raw. It feels as if, you know, it's kind of life and death. And obviously we've seen that in America. And I don't want to be one of those like British commentators who tries to import like American politics to our system. But it does feel like we are downstream of something more radical going on right now. My feeling is that what we're actually living through right now is an economic revolution. It's a revolution that's actually being led by the right, not by the left. The right have the ideas around how to shut down the border so that no illegal immigrants can come in, to rephase the economy using AI to get productivity gains and to make money, to deregulate, right, to financialize. These are ideas that often many people on the left, because they don't have a strong understanding of economics, and by the way, we're no economists, we're just trying to figure out what's left, you know, that most people don't understand these things. So what they do buy into is the slogan, right? Make America great again. Make Britain great again. Reform Britain. Britain does need reform. Britain does need to change. But it's a change that's currently being led by the right. And what's great about stuff like this today is that you have a crowding of brilliant minds who are all in different contexts negotiating the same problem. I'm not saying that the answers are there yet. I'm not saying that I feel like, and we're gonna talk a bit now, I think, about a few of those problems. But this is exactly the sort of thing that needs to be happening. And the right have been doing it for ages. You know about CPAC. You've seen the conservative conferences where they trade ideas. They're all on the phone to each other.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, they're all in constant communications. And this seems to be, at least in my view, the first attempt of trying to create something vaguely similar to that, an intellectual capacity to actually bring the fight to the right wing. Because what we're seeing, as I've said before, is people like ourselves, progressive-minded people who want something better for society, have been on the back foot. And not only are we in kind of an economic conflict and convergence, we're also in a, I would say, a bit of a metaphysical one. The conditions by which we interact and engage with each other, exactly like what we're doing now, has completely changed. And the left needs to catch up with that. And so this is a fundamental aspect of the revolution that we're in. It's not just, as Freddie quite rightly recognises, an economic one, but it is about how we actually perceive ourselves, how we relate to community.
How we communicate.
How we communicate. Yeah. But how we move forward together in hopes to build a bit more of a sustainable, equitable and prosperous society. Something that I think we all deserve. All want
and we all want to
and
see
we
it.
Expect
yeah,
exactly
we
yeah.
all want to see it. And I think immigration is still obviously the topic of the day, and it's one of the big topics that I'll be discussing now. The government's just announced they're introducing digital ID cards.
This government will make a new free of charge digital ID mandatory for the right to work by the end of this parliament.
So this is something that Tony Blair, even with all the political capital that he had, could never do. And now Prime Minister Starmer, who's not in the best of positions right now, is introducing it. There was a briefing in the Times today that privately the Prime Minister was quite worried about how this was going to be received by the general public. Like, would people see it as a crackdown on civil liberties? We know that two-tier policing narrative is strong on the left and on the right. And there's a sense that people don't have trust in institutions.
And yet he's trying to bring in this thing called digital ID, a digital ID card, which means that you can show to the government, to people in the NHS, to, you know, whoever requires it of you. They have not specified who is going to require it of you, but who you are. It's going to be incumbent on working age people to have this, not pensioners. What do you think of the digital ID card stuff, Joanne?
I mean, I'm a huge cynic of digital ID. Firstly, I don't remember it being in the manifesto that I stood on when I was contesting a seat down in Clacton. I don't remember it being part of the Labour manifesto. But I think it poses a whole range of questions for civil liberties, for minority communities up and down Britain. I think it, to a point, concedes some of the ground of the sophistication as to how we police ourselves, how we police our borders. Just because our European neighbours are using this technology to control and see where aspects of their citizens are going, I don't think that's the type of society I want to live in. I think we have to have a more rigorous public discussion before any political party or prime minister can just impose this onto a population that hasn't given its democratic mandate to it in an election.
I think the democratic mandate point is worth bearing in mind. Absolutely. I think the issue is that, you know, as you said, Europe has this and we don't. And people might think that we left the EU so that we could have sovereignty over decisions like this. And I think that that is definitely something worth highlighting. But what's the argument for digital ID? Like, why do Europe have it? Europe has digital ID because they think that it's a necessary means to being able to track and know who's in your country, right? And at a time when, I guess, you have an insecure southern border, when we see boats, you know, with illegal immigrants coming in every day, there's a concern that people don't know who's in this country. And the government doesn't have a handle on these things. And so the government, I think, is trying to, through technological, technocratic means, you know, get a handle on these things. And that's why they felt the need to introduce it.
But the crux of this question for me is one about freedom. Are we born as free citizens? And I think this draws into question that big kind of imperative and kind of moral place that we have of ourselves. Are we free? We saw some of these questions asked during the kind of COVID days when we saw the state impose all of us to stay into our houses. And that was a massive conversation around who we are as a society.
There was a mandate for that in
Well, to a point, there was a mandate around that because there was a massive global crisis. But we're in a different situation now where the effects of immigration and some of these things aren't the same effects affected by all. And so I think the crux of it is freedom. The crux of it are individual liberties. And this is what the right have, they've grasped that zeitgeist of the day, which is people don't feel free. They don't feel a sense of economic freedom, of political freedom, of whatever freedoms, hence the kind of two-tier narratives. Mm. And to me, this only propagates more of that argument, which is quite unhelpful to any progressive government. And I'm curious to see how the debates unravel over the coming weeks around digital ID. But for me, I remain a cynic around that idea.
What I will say about digital ID is that I'm not 100% landing in favour or completely against. I'm seeing some of the reasons why the government want to bring this in. I understand the desire for the government to see, to have levers to pull, to be able to control immigration, to be able to understand who is coming in and who isn't coming out of the country. Of course, like anyone, I'm worried about how that could be abused. But I think that that's a sign of the fact that people just don't trust governments anymore to be able to do the right thing, to be able to do the effective thing. And the fact is that we do have a mandate from the population of this country to lower immigration. And clearly, it's much harder to do in practice than people have said in promises at elections, right? So I don't think that the government have come to do this out of sheer, you know, want. And I think they're doing it out of necessity. And, you know, I might be wrong. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't. You know, I find it hard to look at some of these officials that we get to meet and you know, look them in the eye and think what you're trying to do here is like bring in some dystopian, I don't know, like Handmaid's Tale sort of thing.
But this is all being brought under the guise of a kind of patriotic renewal. The idea that we can walk into a kind of new future for the country, one that is more technologically advanced and there is greater ease in some of our access to some of the essentials that we all need. I don't know how much some of this kind of symbology or this technology is actually going to instigate a greater sense of community. Is it just going to enable us to turn more effectively in on our neighbour, in on our communities, in on some of the people who sustain the lifestyle of our country that we need so necessarily? I'm not too sure that this is something that is going to bring about all of the goods that we want to see. Instead, I think it could inspire quite a hostile and dismissive attitude to some of the people who have made their home here in the UK. And that's where my reservations of digital ID come in.
I think one thing to also bear in mind is that this isn't just coming from our government, right? Like when Macron came to visit the UK, he mentioned as a pull factor for migrants coming here is the fact that the UK doesn't have digital ID, doesn't have robust measures in his eyes to be able to map and understand who is in your country at what time, right? And you know, we want the UK to move closer to Europe, I think, you know, you and I mean,
to a point, yeah.
I think we want to have a closer strategic relationship with them. And, you know, this one in, one out policy that the government has pursued, which is to make sure that anyone who comes in from France, that they get, essentially for any person that comes in, someone's already gone out when it comes to immigration. If we want to uphold that policy, I think that some of these concessions around digital ID have been part of the puzzle. We will see if this is a good thing or not, and we will be completely honest and sober in our analysis.
Another key factor of the conference today, no doubt, will be the economy. Rachel Reeves has been on a mission to grow the economy, and we've seen that most recently through authorising a second runway at Gatwick Airport. There seems to be levers she's trying to pull to ensure that the country is more productive and more prosperous. We're yet to see how this will manifest and some of the conversations that will emerge. But what do you think the centre-left has to offer on the economy in the face of a kind of growing right-wing populism?
Look, it's the word of the moment, growth. Growth, growth, growth. We haven't had it for years. And the government thinks that if you can get growth, you can fix this country, right? A lot of people want to know what the fix is for populism, and many think that it's just improving people's material lives. How can the government do that? The government needs to have more money to be able to spend and invest in its country, in its infrastructure, in its people. And the only way it's going to get that money is if we have a growing and productive economy, not just by taxing people to the nines, right? And that is just the old school, you know, orthodox view of how you make politics work. Now, the thing that I am concerned about is that the only place that has growth right now is tech, essentially. And I'm not sure that the AI revolution is going to lead to a place where there are more jobs, right? There are more people in, you know, important, meaningful work that gives them a sense of themselves, prosperity and, you know, a future plan. I'm not sure that AI is going to be able to bring that. What have we seen so far? Graduate joblessness, right? It's not just deindustrialized communities now who have to worry about not having a job. It's the kids who've gone to university.
Entry-level jobs are vanishing at an alarming rate.
And I just think that if we're following America down this line of, you know, AI boosterism, this idea that AI is going to fix, it's going to be a panacea, it's going to be the silver bullet that just fixes everything, I'm just not sure that that's going to work out, right? And that seems to be part of the government's plan at the moment, because it's the only place that they can get money for investment. So on the other hand, I'm also going, well, you know, the UK AI deal with the US, right?
$30 billion into UK artificial intelligence infrastructure by 2028. Betting big on Britain's technological future as part of a US-UK tech agreement, which includes the likes of Google, Nvidia and OpenAI.
We declare that UK will be an AI superpower. And that was the mandate from Prime Minister Starmer.
I mean, where are we getting that level of investment right now?
Yeah.
So I think that this is one of the kind of inherent tensions that this conference is going to be talking about a lot, is how AI is obviously going to be part of the revolution to governance. It's going to be part of how to make governments work better. But is it going to actually transform our societies in a way that was going to make us more cohesive, you know, better functioning? I'm struggling to see it right now.
And just what is the UK economy for the century coming up? Because AI is only one aspect of that economy. We still need the raw materials and the infrastructure and the skills and the capacity and all the kind of traditional elements of a labour market for AI to be a success. So outside of this kind of one singular aspect of the economy that is having so much money being pumped into it, we still need to ensure that the economy is working for everybody up and down the country. And a centre-left project has to be acutely aware of that and how historically particular communities have been overlooked, have been deindustrialised, and how equitably we're going to resource such communities so much so that they do have that agency. And this is a fundamental question, I think, to the centre-left project, to a left-wing project, if it is to succeed. Because, as you said, AI is not the silver bullet that is going to fix all of our problems. There are a myriad of issues that the country faces, and that is potentially just one of them.
I think this is as much a problem for the right as the left, right? The right have made promises to reshore industry to make sure that these communities that have been left behind do have jobs, you know, do get investment. And, you know, whether they're going to be able to provide that with all of the kind of productivity gains that will be made by people losing their jobs is a question for them as well. And they're going to be in other boardrooms trying to figure that out. But as we kind of know with the right, the only thing that matters is the dollar sign at the end of it. So as long as the money's right, don't bet on them trying to figure out all the other social stuff.
So this week, the government announced a £5 billion neighbourhood high streets investment fund, which off the bat to me is a good thing. This is something that is going to bring back a sense of community to many areas up and down the country, in places like where I grew up in West Brom. This is essential to kind of revitalising civic life in our country. And it's incumbent upon local authorities to actually ensure they not only consult, but engage and ensure there's agency amongst people to determine the affairs of their own areas to make sure that's better. So I think this is a welcome kind of addition from the government. And I really hope that local authorities take a leading role with communities to ensure that areas just are much better than they are now.
Yeah, I mean, look, councils need money to spend to invest in their communities, right? We know that a dead high street is like a metaphor for a country and a community that's in decline. It used to be a place where people would socialize. The closure of third spaces, you know, makes real, I guess, the atomization of all of us as people, that we don't belong to a tribe, that we don't have a sense of, you know, community and belonging, and that we can't communicate with each other because we don't have the space to communicate. That's a problem that the government is trying to address, and they're doing it through investment. This is exactly the sort of thing that a Labour government should be doing. I wish it was happened earlier, but I'm glad that it's happening now. And as you said, it really is reliant on those councils making the right decisions with those communities on what to invest in. I would personally love to see investment into community hubs for young people. You know, people are worried about antisocial behaviour right now. And I think that is very much a consequence of a lot of young people having a load of time and nothing to do with it. So wouldn't it be great if we had community hubs and centres, youth clubs back again, thriving as a place for young people to come? I work with a company called the Advocacy Academy in Brixton.
Big ups.
Which is, yeah, big ups, the Advocacy Academy. This is a place where they're mobilising young people for political engagement. People come here after school, they come here to hang out with their mates, and they learn stuff together. And they have a sense of themselves and their community, and it makes them motivated to change the world. We're living in times where people need to have that, otherwise things are going to get so much worse. And I think this is the type of investment that is going to be a genuine force for good. Okay, we've got something a little bit special for you. We've managed to bag an interview with Frank Sharees, one of the panelists today at the conference who's talking on immigration. Frank was the lead for the Biden and Harris campaign on immigration last year. He's learned a lot from his mistakes and is sharing with us some of that information. He's also the founder and executive of America's Voice, which is a liberal immigration reforming think tank. Frank, we're at the Global Progress Action Summit. What are your thoughts today after your panel this morning on migration?
Well, center-left forces across Western democracies are challenged. On the one hand, you have a highly mobilized right wing that is weaponizing the issue in their quest for power. And you also have often very strong voices on the left, which are proposing maximalist solutions. And center-left governments and parties are like, where do we land? What we were talking about, though, in the Spanish example, the Danish example, American example, is that you really need to strike a balance. You need to be for control, but also for immigration. And that if you have a robust legal immigration system combined with effective controls, that you can pursue progressive goals of admitting people into your country so they have better opportunity, and do so in a way that's politically sustainable with publics who want to make sure that the immigration is serving their interests and reflecting their values.
And can you explain a little bit about, you know, the wide scope of your role when you were in the Biden administration?
Well, I worked as an advocate and activist for about 40 years, but then I got very concerned that Trump was going to get reelected. So I joined the Biden and Harris presidential campaign. Biden obviously dropped out, worked, and Harris leaned in on immigration much more. So I became sort of the principal advisor on that issue. Unfortunately, Biden got it wrong for too long. He didn't address the surge in border arrivals, 2 million a year for 3 years. And as a result, Trump and the Republican Party labeled it the Biden border crisis, and he's the head of a party of open borders. Harris came in and with only 107 days, really leaned in to get that balance right, but it was too late.
But she was in charge of the border, right?
Like, well, she wasn't in charge of the border, but she did have a track record that was not distinguished.
Right.
On it. She was in charge of addressing root causes with the Republicans, with the complicity of mainstream media, tagged her as an open borders kind of advocate, and it was really unfair. But she was never able to distance herself from the Biden administration's failures because she was part of it. And her last push to redefine herself was too little too late. I think what Democrats in the United States have to find, and I think this is true in different ways and in different countries, is sort of an authentic way to talk about that we're a nation of immigrants and a nation of laws, and that the best way to be either is to be both. And that when you have control, the public is much more supportive of legal immigration. And when you don't have control, they're much less supportive. So Trump profited politically from the sense that there was chaos at the border. And what he's doing now is hugely unpopular with the public because he's got masked agents, you know, roaming neighborhoods and picking up brown people on suspicion and removing them to foreign gulags if he can. So it's a horrible situation. And a lot of voters said, we didn't vote for this. Well, you voted for a guy who's been a radical right winger on immigration for a long time. And unfortunately, it's going to take a change in government to really pull back from, I think, what is going to likely go down as one of the worst chapters in American history.
And what's shocking, I guess, for progressives all around the world is that they see Trump doubling down on this immigration as a success of his government. That when he goes to the UN, for instance, the way he chastises other countries is their failure to get control over the border in the way that he's been able to. You had commentators like Piers Morgan saying,
what can we learn from Donald Trump? A lot. He's actually achieved, you can hate Trump all you like, but you cannot deny what he's done on the southern border in America is a spectacular success. And under Trump, he's pretty well stopped it stone dead. Now, there are aspects of his immigration policy that I think have gone too far that I wouldn't like to see replicated here.
It's so simplistic as to be almost ridiculous. But look, the numbers have come down at the border. They came down in year four of the Biden administration by 81%, and they've gone down further under Trump. What he's done, though, is he's made America so unattractive to immigrants that they don't want to come anymore. So, yeah, if you I would say, for example, in the UK, if you want to make sure that people don't come here illegally, have a mass deportation strategy that goes after people of color, whether they're here legally or not. And that's what Trump is doing. And so it's a really dark chapter in American history. And to call it a success when he's violating international treaties, when he's violating due process, when he's sending people to foreign gulags, it's awful. I mean, and so that's why at this point, only 35% of the American people support his mass deportation policies. Yes, something like 45% support his border security. They don't know how he did it. They don't know that he violated the law in multiple ways to make sure that nobody gets in. But the real reason that people aren't coming is that they don't want to come to a place where when they leave the house, they could be picked up by masked agents.
And do you think that parties like Reform in the UK, who are often inspired by Trump's rhetoric and MAGA's policy, will be looking at the efficacy, quote unquote, of getting what they wanted out of their border control and thinking that they could apply some of those lessons here to the UK?
Well, they already are, aren't they?
Nigel Farage has today unveiled Reform's controversial plan to deport hundreds of thousands of legal migrants.
I mean, that is not where the British people are. I mean, there are a hardcore group of haters in this country, many of whom showed up at that march in London just a few weeks ago. But the idea that that represents the fairness and decency of the British people is a real miss. And I think that it's going to come back to haunt him. I do think they're aping Trump. And I do think Trump is so unpopular in this country, in the UK, that his embrace of his most radical policies that have backfired in America are going to backfire even more here in the UK.
Do you think it exposes how in hoc Nigel Farage is to Trump and to MAGA, that they really can't think of any ideas themselves, that they just have to copy them from abroad?
I mean, you know, Nigel Farage, he was asked about Trump saying that pregnant women shouldn't take what we call Tylenol.
Nor would I follow the World Health Organization.
When Donald Trump talks about links between paracetamol or Tylenol and autism, is he right?
I have no idea.
You think he might be right?
I have no idea. You know, we were told thalidomide was a very safe drug and it wasn't. Who knows? Nick, I don't know. You don't know.
If you want a Trumpian-style government in the UK, which I don't think the majority or anywhere near the majority in this UK want, yeah, you can count on reform to mimic Trump as much as possible.
I mean, what's doubly interesting about this is the fact that Nigel Farage is meant to be learning from his mistakes. And over again, the British public have told him that the UK does not want to be America. Yet over and over again, he seems to be pushing the UK towards America. I mean, why do you think America right now is going through such psychosis, it seems, internally to its allies? Why is there such a sense of breakdown in trust in American communities?
Oh, there's many reasons, but I'll just say it bluntly. We made a really stupid mistake electing Trump the first time and an even stupider mistake electing him a second time. And it just goes to show that how many people are informed by the kind of media ecosystem in America dominated by the right wing, where conspiracy theories and criticisms of mainstream politicians and mainstream institutions has taken hold. America is in a really, really dark place right now. I don't know what it's going to take to pull us out of it, but I don't think it's too much to say it's akin to the Civil War, that we'll be lucky to survive this in terms of a recognizable, pluralistic, and democratic society.
And if America has a war, the whole world catches a cold, as the saying goes. UK partners are still looking to American, to people in the Democrats, for instance, for some guidance, I feel, about a political project that can really unite the progressive left. Who do you fancy as someone who could unite the Democrat Party and bring about a political project that could unite the global left against global populism?
I don't think that leadership's going to come from America, to be blunt. I mean, America's a cautionary tale, and we're still sorting out the lessons of how we fell so far so fast. And so we have something to offer. But I think the prime ministers that you saw in today's program from Canada and from Iceland and from Australia and from the UK, they're the new leaders, Spain and New Zealand. It's just, I mean, America is going to be continue to be a selfish, inwardly looking, bombastic, bullying society as long as the MAGA movement dominates American politics. And they're quite likely to try to, you know, rig the election so that they stay in power. I think Mark Carney gets it right, even though they're the neighbors of the U.S. and major trading partner, they're looking elsewhere to like-minded governments to try to boost security, trade and alliances.
And returning to immigration, do you think that the UK is learning the lessons here of the progressive left globally in terms of trying to exact some level of control whilst also making a case for some immigration? Because, of course, we're going to need it. We've got an aging society.
Yes.
We want to be an inclusive place. We want to also be a place with an integrated common culture where people feel a sense of belonging in their communities. Do you think the Prime Minister has a good handle on that?
I'm hopeful, but I think the jury is still out. Britain has benefited hugely by migration. It's been a leader in protecting refugees.
I'm an example of it.
I mean, it's a successful, multicultural, modern society. The reason that so many people want to come to this country is because it's dynamic, diverse, and a happening place. So I don't think that's said enough by this government. I understand their desire to talk about controls because that is absolutely necessary. I think the UK-France agreement is a good basis, if ramped up, big if ramped up sufficiently, could actually bring down the boat arrivals at the same time that you have safe and legal routes for those who are admitted through an orderly process. So I have hope. I think the new Home Secretary probably gets it as well. And I think she's lived the immigrant experience as well as knows what it is to be a sovereign nation that protects its border. So, you need a balance, and you need to have an instinct for what the right balance is for your country. And I think that Labour is on track, but implementing it and making sure that you deliver in terms of bringing voter arrivals down whilst increasing legal pathways, it's a challenge to operationalize. If they get that right, I think they'll be able to call it a big win.
And that'll be a playbook for other, progressive parties to copy all over the world.
Indeed. It is in some ways similar to what Australia has done. They've limited boat arrivals and increased legal immigration. Look, publics that are in favor of legal immigration, or favor of immigration, want it legal, not illegal. Want people to come through an orderly and vetted system and a cap system rather than, come with smugglers and avoid vetting. So I don't think that's anti-progressive. I think the progressives need to listen to that and get that balance right. I think that if the Labour government can bring the boat arrivals down and with France have orderly legal pathways, that they might actually be able to talk more positively about immigration and even lift the net migration.
And Australia is really instructive here, right? You had very strict controls on immigration, far stricter than the left in this country would have countenanced for a very long time. But now they are upping the numbers of asylum seekers that they're taking. So they've created communities of trust and belonging who are consenting now for the popular will politically to more people coming into their country. I think that's very instructive for the UK.
It is. For too long, the progressive left has said, we want to protect immigrants, and border security doesn't protect immigrants. I think what center-left governments have to be able to stand and operationalize is we are for immigrants coming into our country, and we are for border security, and they work together. And I think that if this government can get that right, both in policy and in narrative, I think they're going to go into the next election in a much more powerful position.
And if they can't, do you think that's probably fatal for the Labour Party?
I think if the boat situation continues to be such a big issue, often number one in the polls these days, weaponized by the right, I think there's a huge swath of voters who are concerned about it and can lose hope and lose trust in government if you can't solve it. We saw that with the Biden administration. I mean, this issue was a real hindrance to their reelection prospects. And again, Harris couldn't run far enough away from it soon enough. I think they'd be in real trouble if they don't. That's where I'm confident. I think there's no question that the Labour government takes this issue seriously, wants to get it done, has the right strategy, just needs to be able to ramp up with France to do so.
Finally, a bit of a pivot, but on this point about backsliding and authoritarianism in the US, I sense there's a bit of disquiet amongst the Democrat strategists between some people who are very alarmed by what Trump is doing and with the power of the executive, and others who think that pushing a narrative around authoritarianism isn't a vote winner. It isn't what's going to change the dial ultimately for voters who are the kingmakers at the next election. Where do you stand on that debate? Do you think people should be clamoring about Trump's fears of being a king, or do you think we should just focus directly on policy?
I think we should walk and chew gum. I mean, there's no question that Trump is the biggest threat to democracy in America that we've witnessed in over 100 years. We need to call that out. That is what the voters who support the Democratic Party are most concerned about. And Trump made big promises on cost of living that he's not delivering on, just the opposite. So you can say, he's maybe connect the two, that in fact, he's more interested in being a king than he is in delivering for the people. He's helping his oligarchs, but he's not helping you. So I think there's a way to connect the threat to democracy and the failure to bring down the cost of living. But Democrats spend too much time on tactics and focus groups and not enough time just being authentic. We're alarmed at the authoritarian project of Trump. Our democracy is hanging by a thread. And if we don't call it out now, when are we? That's not to say that that's going to be the only issue we talk about or the main issue that's going to win. But if we don't address what is in front of people, and in fact, the polls show that people are growing increasingly alarmed. A lot of people said, I don't like Trump. He's kind of a wild man, but he's going to break the system and bring down costs. Well, he's breaking the system without bringing down costs, and he's breaking the system for oligarchs who he treats like they're part of his royal court. Mm. And that is not what people voted for. And I think that connection between authoritarianism and unfairness is going to be a powerful message in the upcoming midterms.
And that final thing about oligarchy, you know, maybe we've got to a place where our systems aren't quite working in the right way if we've got oligarchs determining the politics of the US and therefore the world.
You know, a recent interview with Zoran Mamdani, the very popular insurgent character, he was asked,
do you think that billionaires have a right to exist?
I don't think that we should have billionaires because, frankly, it is so much money in a moment of such inequality.
And I think that's the attitude the Democratic Party should take. I'm sorry. Why are some people becoming so fabulously wealthy that they could literally fund entire deficits in states and on, you know, medical services, et cetera? And we have to listen to them tell us what our public policy should be because they have more money. I think the country is ripe for a very strong populist message on economics and fairness, and perhaps a little less stridency when it comes to some of the woke identity politics issues.
So at this summit today, we've got people from the US, from Canada, from Australia, from Spain, from social democratic parties all over the world coming here to discuss the issues of the day. And number one on that list for a lot of these Americans is the authoritarian backsliding that they're seeing in the US. Now, one of the interesting conversations that will be going on in private at this conference and at places, you know, beyond is how worried should people who care about democracy be by Donald Trump's, you know, abuse of the executive right now in America? There's a really interesting question here for you to think about when it comes to campaigning, right? At the end of the Kamala campaign last year, they tried to land this blow on Donald Trump that he was going to be an authoritarian, right? That he was going to take away your democratic rights. And it didn't work. The US ultimately voted and a popular vote for Donald Trump. And I think that there's something important to remember here is that people don't really know what democracy is. You know, they know that there is a thing that they're a political system that they participate in, but they're not really sure about these kind of like values and, you know, these like nuanced bits of philosophy that underpin it. What they want is a system where they say something and then something happens, right? And on immigration, for instance, they've got that. It's been horrible as someone who broadly wants more immigration, but thinks we need to lower the numbers. It's horrible to see ICE agents do what they've done in America, but we have to remember that for a certain bit of their population, that is democracy to them because that's what they voted for. And I think that it's really important to not just attack Trump on being this kind of demagogue who is broadly comedic, but also takes away people's rights, but to just get to him on the things that he's not providing for Americans, which is fundamentally changing their living standards. If in America, the cost of living is as bad, if not worse than it was before he took over, the center left has a chance to win. And then the other side of the ledger is relevant to us here in the UK. If we do not improve people's living standards, if people's lives do not materially improve, then we're out of government in a few years' time. Anything else you want to add on that?
No, you stunted me.
Well, that was a good one. Was that a good one? Okay, yeah, you're dropping bombs. look, we're gassed to be here. I mean, to be honest with you, we're just riffing, hearing some of the stuff that we've heard today in that room, seeing some of the speakers come out and say their piece. We don't know yet what the answer is, but it does feel like the left is in need of an intellectual revolution. It's in need of a new project to hang its hat on. And that could be a rival to the populist right insurgency. That could be the thing that gives us hope for a better future.